Okay, welcome everybody to our Memphis Lawyers Chapter of Federal Society program today. We have an excellent CLE program entitled The Tennessee Constitution, Its History and Key Distinctives. And we're very honored and pleased to have with us today Justice Holly Kirby from the Tennessee Supreme Court, who's been very kind in the past, help us with our programs and to appear in numerous past programs. And so we appreciate her being here today. Before we get started, I'd like just to encourage everybody, if you want to get CLE credit, put your BPR number in the Q&A box. And if you forget to do it, just send me an email when the program's over. We'll make sure you get CLE credit. This is a complimentary program. There's no charge for it. So we encourage you, if you need CLE credit, to apply for it. And if you have questions as we go forward, please put them in the Q&A box. What we'll probably do is we'll let Justice Kirby speak as long as she wants to. And when she is ready to stop, what we'll do is I'll pass on the questions that you have. So I encourage everybody to ask questions. This is a pretty interesting topic. I hate to admit this, I've been practicing law 31 years. I don't know much of anything about Tennessee Constitution, so I'm hoping to learn a lot about it today. So I'd like to go ahead and introduce Justice Kirby. Many of y'all, or most of y'all, maybe all of y'all know her. She's been around a long time and has, of course, been on the Tennessee Supreme Court since 2014. She was on the Tennessee Court of Appeals for almost 19 years. It was actually when she was appointed in 1995, she was the first woman to ever sit on the Court of Appeals. She is a proud graduate of the University of Memphis, undergraduate and also law school, where she graduated with high honors. And she was on the Law Review and then had a period where she clerked on the Sixth Circuit. And then was with Birch Porter & Johnson here in Memphis, was a partner in the firm, and was actually the first female partner of the firm when she was selected in 1990. And also she has a background, practiced labor and employment law, which is my area. So we appreciate having her on the court as she understands these kinds of issues. And we're also pleased to have Duncan Bride, her law clerk, here today. He's gonna assist with the PowerPoint. So. Justice Kirby, welcome to the program, and we appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Greg. And I appreciate you asking me to talk about this topic. In my day job, I get to dip into the Tennessee Constitution and study pieces of it as it comes up in a case. And this particular presentation gave me an excuse to take a broader look at it and do some comparing it to our federal Constitution. So I've enjoyed it, and I hope all of you will enjoy it too. I'm going to talk with you about the history of our Tennessee Constitution and then some of the provisions in it that are not in the federal Constitution. Lest you think this is strictly academic, the topic of various constitutional provisions going back to the time when Tennessee first became a state has come up in a number of real life cases that we've heard just since I've been on the Supreme Court, and that's only about 7 years. And they came up with some regularity before that when I was on the Court of Appeals too. So learning about our state constitution may seem a little theoretical or ivory tower, but it's actually pragmatic and quite useful. The United States Constitution is what most of us studied in law school, and it's more familiar to lawyers and to the public. State constitutions, though, have been coming into the light more and more. Not only do they have provisions that differ from the federal constitution, they also have a different history and a different orientation. On questions involving interpretation of the state constitution, of course, the state's high court is the last word. The only question for the United States Supreme Court on those issues is whether the state constitutional provision conflicts with the federal constitution, in which case federal constitution controls, obviously, under the supremacy clause. So let's talk for a moment about the history of state constitutions in general, how they differ from the history of the United States Constitution, and then we'll talk some about the history of the Tennessee Constitution in particular. State constitutions are not just miniature versions of the United States Constitution. Just as the functions of the state and federal governments are different from one another, their constitutions are different as well. The federal constitution is a grant of power from the states to the federal government. As a result, the powers of the federal government are enumerated and limited. The 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution orients us basically on how to interpret state constitutions versus the federal constitution. It says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So we interpret the United States Constitution from that vantage point, that the federal government only has the powers the states expressly delegated to it in the federal Constitution. To determine the state's powers under the 10th Amendment, we look first at whether the United States Constitution expressly granted a particular power to the federal government. If not, we look at whether the federal Constitution prohibits states from exercising a particular power. Beyond that, the powers that are reserved to the states are numerous and indefinite. In Federalist number 45, James Madison said, the powers that remain in the state governments, quote, extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people, and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. But the powers reserved to the states are not without boundary. Note that the 10th Amendment speaks of powers not delegated to the United States or reserved to the states as reserved to the people. The rights and powers of the people existed before state constitutions were drafted. The people had the inherent right of self-government and had formed rules and governments before they decided to draft constitutions. State constitutions are not the source of the people's rights. They are the result of the people's exercise of their power. Both the United States Constitution and the state constitutions exist in order to protect the people's pre-existing rights and powers. In constitutional interpretation, it's important to remember that the states collectively enacted the federal constitution, but state constitutions were voted on directly by the people of each respective state. This difference can affect any search for the original meaning of state constitutional provisions. For example, instead of looking only at the original intent of the state's founding representatives, some state Supreme Courts try to glean how voters of that time would have understood the state constitutional language. Often state constitutional provisions have to be interpreted according to that state's own unique origins. Constitutional provisions may have been adopted by citizens in response to circumstances and events in that particular state. For example, as we'll talk about a little bit later, Tennessee enacted very robust separation of powers provisions in its constitution. This was done partly in reaction to particular actions by Tennessee's legislature. In some instances, though, you're dealing with state constitutional provisions that were may not have been included in the federal constitution, but were widely adopted by most or all of the states. in those instances, interpretations often, interpretation of those provisions often requires us to factor in the national conversation that was going on at that time. For example, this has impacted our interpretation of the right to jury trial provision in Tennessee's Constitution. It became important to take note of the importance of the right to jury trial to American revolutionaries in their struggle with British authorities. In fact, in those days, juries in cases were deciding both the facts and the law as a mechanism to help the colonists resist unfair British laws. Later, as the nation matured, states settled into a power-sharing arrangement where juries decided the facts and judges decided the law. And that is where we have ended up. So national history at times has to be taken into account when interpreting widely adopted state constitutional provision. Sometimes interpretation requires us to go back even further to the colonists' experience with England. After the Continental Congress advised the 13 colonies to reorganize their governments, each state began preparing constitutions. Most were patterned after the Magna Carta. For example, as with a number of states, Tennessee's open courts clause harkens back to that history. So with that framing, let's talk a bit about the history of Tennessee's Constitution. When you look closely, there's a story behind every item and every clause in our Constitution. Tennessee's first Constitution was adopted in 1796, the year Tennessee was admitted to the Union. Originally, North Carolina had authority over most of what is now Tennessee until it finally ceded the territory to the United States in 1790. Some of Tennessee's oldest common law, such as property laws, have their basis in North Carolina common law. This may affect the views of some scholars who say that Tennessee's first constitution was essentially copied from the North Carolina Constitution. But the committee appointed to draft Tennessee's proposed constitution actually came from a lot of different states: Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, South Carolina. And when you compare the first constitution with those of other states, it indicates that those drafters probably borrowed from a number of states' constitutions. Most state constitutions, including Tennessee's 1796 constitution, reflected the colonists' experience with British tyranny and the monarchy. They initially viewed state executives or governors as the part of state government that was the most dangerous. The state legislatures, on the other hand, represented the people and were the least likely to be tyrannical. The 1796 Constitution basically vested the governmental power in the General Assembly. The governor was charged with executing the laws, but he didn't have very much real power. The judiciary was made entirely subordinate to the legislature. The legislature had the ability to enact private acts, overrule the judiciary, settle private controversies, and even grant divorces. To properly interpret the constitutional amendments that followed, it's important to understand the context, the problems that people perceived with state governments generally, and with Tennessee's government in particular. I'll dive into one example. Nationally, many states that had purposefully crafted constitutions that gave expansive powers to their general assemblies found that some of them abused those powers. Time and again, state legislatures across the new country interfered with governors' legitimate powers, rejected judicial decisions, and disregarded individual liberties and property rights. In Tennessee, the General Assembly frequently appointed and removed judges, rearrange the network of courts, and pass private acts to overturn or decide cases. Newspapers at that time often included editorial comment about the judiciary and the General Assembly. In 1829, a report of the Senate Judiciary Committee called Tennessee's judicial system the most expensive and least efficient of any in the United States. For this and other reasons related to things like taxation, in 1834, Tennessee convened a constitutional convention to write a new constitution. The journal of that convention shows the delegates and committees discussed the General Assembly's overreach. As a solution, they carved out a separate judicial branch and proposed explicit separation of powers provisions for the new Constitution. Keep in mind that the federal Constitution does not contain an explicit separation of powers clause at all. Tennessee's history shows us why our state chose to make it explicit. In 1835, Tennessee citizens adopted the new Constitution. It included several structural changes to state government, including separation of powers, and significant revisions to the Declaration of Rights. It included an open courts clause and did things like prohibiting the legislature from granting divorces or authorizing lotteries. Importantly, the Declaration of Rights was moved from the end of the Constitution to the very beginning. After that, the 1835 Constitution was amended twice. In 1853, it was amended to provide for the popular election of all judges and attorneys general to shorten their term of office. And in 1865, Tennessee adopted amendments to recognize property rights and to abolish slavery. Interestingly, the vote on those constitutional amendments was restricted to persons who agreed to take an unconditional oath of allegiance to the Union. As an aside, you may have seen articles recently about a resolution currently pending in our legislature to amend the state constitution to forbid slavery under all circumstances. There were headlines because a few senators did not vote for it. That resolution is because the 1865 constitutional amendment abolishing slavery had an exception for persons who are convicted of a crime. The resolution currently pending in our legislature, as I understand it, would remove that exception. In 1870, in the wake of the Civil War, Tennessee held another constitutional convention and adopted a new constitution again. It largely incorporated the earlier 1835 constitution, but it had some significant changes. It revised the Declaration of Rights to prohibit both political and religious tests for public office, to prohibit political or religious tests for jury service, and to permit those who had sympathized with the Confederacy to vote. The new Constitution extended the right to bear arms to all citizens. Unlike the federal Constitution, Tennessee's new constitution expressly empowered our legislature to regulate the carrying of arms. It substantially weakened the powers of the governor further. Under the new constitution, the governor cannot suspend habeas corpus or declare martial law without the approval of the General Assembly. And the governor's veto can be overridden by only a majority vote in both houses of the legislature. The 1870 Constitution essentially still stands as our Constitution today. We've adopted amendments from time to time, but it's never been overhauled or modernized. In 1853, Tennessee had its first limited constitutional convention, limited to only specific topics. The amendments approved gave the governor a 4-year term, though he couldn't succeed himself. This ended up leading to Governors Frank Clement and Buford Ellington doing leapfrog terms of office as governor. The 1953 constitutional amendments also removed the poll tax and included several measures to strengthen local governments. For example, the amendments prohibited the legislature from passing special or local laws to remove local officials from office. It required local approval of localized legislation. It authorized municipal home rule, and it allowed approval of city-county consolidation. In 1965, a convention was called in response to the United States Supreme Court's decision in Baker versus Carr. Amendments were adopted on reapportionment of the legislature based on population and increasing senators' terms to 4 years and staggering them. The most recent limited constitutional convention was in 1977. The amendments adopted from that convention in 1978, and the amendments were adopted in 1978, and they altered the way vacancies in the legislature are filled. They required our state government to balance the budget. That certainly stands in contrast to the federal government, doesn't it? Tennessee at that time was on the cutting edge for its balanced budget amendment. I think all Tennesseans can take pride in our heritage of fiscal restraint. The amendments adopted in 1978 also allowed the governor to serve two consecutive four-year terms. It allowed 18-year-olds to vote, and it required maintenance of free public schools. It was not until 1978 that Tennessee removed the constitutional prohibition on interracial marriage. Notable constitutional amendments after that did not come through constitutional conventions. Instead, they were passed by resolution of two successive general assemblies and then approved directly by voters. In that way, in 1998, Tennessee adopted the Victims' Rights Amendment. As you can see, it's very detailed. This is a good example of a trend in constitutional amendments, at least in Tennessee. This provision, to me, looks almost like legislation. In contrast, earlier constitutional provisions set out very general principles to be fleshed out later by legislation or by courts or by those responsible for executing the laws. What if the concept of due process had been drafted in the manner of the Victims' Rights Amendment? What would it look like? So we'll have to see how this trend in constitutional provisions plays out over time. In 2014, Tennessee adopted three significant constitutional amendments, one that dealt with abortion, one that prohibited a state income tax, and my personal favorite, a constitutional amendment that provided for appellate judges to be appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature, and then elected in retention elections. Many of you here today participated in winning voters' approvals for the constitutional amendment on retention elections for appellate judges. To this day, I can't thank you enough for all of your hard work. Now let's talk a bit about particular provisions in Tennessee's Constitution that are distinct from the federal Constitution. As I mentioned earlier, the federal Constitution does not contain an express separation of powers clause. At the federal level, separation of powers is instead inferred from the tripartite form of the federal government. The fact that Tennessee's founding citizens made a deliberate decision to include not just one, but several robust provisions related to separation of powers tells us they meant business. We on the court are regularly asked to look at whether legislative enactments transgress separation of powers. So when we are faced with cases that ask us that, we have to keep Tennessee's particular history in mind to interpret the Tennessee Constitution. The Tennessee Constitution contains express provisions guaranteeing the right to vote. These recently came before us in a case involving expansion of access to mail-in ballots in a time of global pandemic. There were no allegations in that case under the federal constitution. That makes some sense. Under principles of federalism, the states are generally responsible for voting for their citizens. In contrast with the federal constitution, Tennessee's constitution has long contained an open courts clause, mandating that all courts shall be open. Most state constitutions have an open courts clause. During the pandemic, our open courts clause has been at the forefront of our minds. Keeping courts open is a real challenge when it's hard for us to just be in physical proximity to one another. I'm not really sure how we would have handled it without modern technology. Some of the changes we ended up making have actually, I think, enhanced the openness of our court proceedings. For example, oral arguments before the Tennessee Supreme Court are now live streamed on the Administrative Office of the Court's YouTube channel. I encourage you to check them out. Anyone sitting in their bedroom in front of their laptop or their smartphone can be present in real time as cases are being argued. Our intermediate appellate courts have been doing the same thing, and lawyers have been telling me that they are watching these arguments. Law schools are telling me that they are having their students watch these arguments. They're enormously educational. And I think it's particularly helpful right now for regular citizens to be able to see in real time how their courts operate. I've encouraged even some of our trial courts to do that. There may be problems with that, but I would love to see some trials actually live streamed. The open courts clause, though, is going to remain a challenge to us as we try to resume in-person court proceedings. For a considerable period of time, we're probably going to have to respect social distancing and take a lot of similar measures. And that may make it more difficult to accommodate media in the courtroom or just ordinary citizens who would like to be present in person for a particular court proceeding. Tennessee's constitution includes a right of trial by jury. That constitutional right comes up with some regularity in our cases. And the history of the provision has informed our application of it to particular factual situations. I mentioned previously that we've considered how the colonists viewed the right to jury trial at its inception, in sorting out what matters would be decided by juries and what matters would be decided by judges. We've also had to consider Tennessee's history, that we were originally part of the territory North Carolina controlled. In determining what kinds of cases were actually tried before juries when Tennessee adopted the right to jury trial, we had to look at some very, very old North Carolina common law. We reached way back, and the lawyers in that case reached way back in Tennessee's history and in North Carolina's history to see how our founding citizens originally conceived that clause in our Constitution. Tennessee's constitution contains an express provision limiting fines to $50 unless assessed by a jury. The Tennessee Supreme Court has observed that not only is there no similar provision in the federal constitution, there's no similar provision in any other modern state constitution like that. The $50 fine provision was made part of Tennessee's constitution in 1796. In that same amount, $50. It's not changed since then. There was an effort to remove it in the early 2000s, but that failed. I can only guess that a whole lot of people who had fines managed to get out and vote, but that's what that provision is, and I guess that's what it's going to stay. Unlike the federal constitution, Tennessee's constitution requires our state government to provide a system of free public schools for all Tennessee citizens. The fact that this is in our state constitution again reflects principles of federalism, that the states are primarily responsible for educating their citizens. If you've ever wondered why we have elected court clerks for our trial courts, that's because it's in the Tennessee Constitution. This provision was part of the 1835 redo of the Constitution, where a separate judicial branch was set up. It doesn't apply to chancery courts because those courts were not in existence in Tennessee when that constitutional provision was adopted. The constitutional amendments that were proposed in 1978 included a very lengthy proposal on several revamps of the judicial branch. That revamp included making trial court clerks appointed instead of elected. That's the only constitutional amendment that was proposed at that time in 1978 that failed. Makes you wonder whether voters' rejection of that particular amendment may have had something to do with all of those locally influential elected court clerks across the state. As you can see, Tennessee's Constitution has a rich and complicated history. Behind every clause in our Constitution, there's a story, and knowing that story helps us understand how it should be applied today. So, Greg, I did not time this correctly. I thought it would last longer. Sorry about that, but we do have time for questions. I'm not guaranteeing that I will have answers, but we do have time for any questions.
Okay. Well, I'm going to encourage everybody in the audience to, or at least some people in the audience, to submit questions. If not, I have a list of everybody who signed up, so I'm going to start calling on people, okay? You don't want me to do that.
So I know exactly. May have some pull with the CLE commission, and I won't tattle that. Maybe our CLE was a little short.
Well, that's okay. All right. What takes place on the Zoom stays on Zoom, okay?
Okay. All right.
I've got a question here. This is from one of our people in the audience, Connor McDaniel. He says, I'm just going to read what he says here because he's got some stuff. Well, his question is, what the role of the state constitution is in protecting individual liberties, and whether those protections should be disregarded in favor of the federal standards? And the backdrop for that is he's interested in situations where the Tennessee constitution provides greater protection than the federal constitution, especially in the criminal context.
That was the point that I was going to make. They're actually Tennessee's law of the land clause is the corollary to the federal due process clause, and it actually has the history of that. Roughly, is that as the composition of the United States Supreme Court evolved from being populated by more liberal justices to being populated by more conservative justices, some of the more liberal or oriented justices, particularly Justice Brennan, began encouraging, actively encouraging state courts to look state Supreme Courts to look to their state constitution. So as the United States Supreme Court began interpreting liberties, individual liberties, in a way that they viewed as more restrictive, state courts, and Tennessee certainly falls in this category, began interpreting our state constitutional provisions in a way that was more protective, for example, of criminal defendants. You will notice that this happened a lot, for example, in the 1990s, when our state Supreme Court everybody in state government at that time were Democrats, some were conservative, some were liberal, but there were a fair number of more liberal justices on the state Supreme Court. And you will see a lot of decisions during that time period that interpret our state constitutional provisions and especially individual liberties for criminal defendants in a way that is very protective of criminal defendants. And interestingly, many of those cases, if you look at the reasoning, they will cite the state constitutional provision, but they won't really look to the language of our state constitution as indicating that it should be more protective of criminal defendants' rights. They won't look necessarily at the history of the Tennessee Constitution to indicate that it should be that way. They'll really just state the principle and cite that provision of Tennessee's state constitution. That effectively insulated those holdings by our state Supreme Court from any retrenchment by the legislature at that time. So that's actually a very good question and is part of the history of Tennessee's constitution. And that's part of what we are faced with on the Supreme Court every day. And that produces, as the composition of our state Supreme Court has changed, that always produces a tension, if you will, between the concept of stare decisis and the judicial philosophies of perhaps some of the individual members on the court when we are faced with some of those holdings.
Well, thank you, Justice Kirby. You have another question here. Could you speak to the history of the unique selection of the Attorney General?
I can speak anecdotally. I have not researched it. Tennessee is the only state that has that particular selection system for the Attorney General. Somebody in the chat may know better than me. It's my understanding that if you go back and research when that was adopted, and that was adopted, I want to say the 1870 Constitution, but I'm not 100% on that. It was adopted for that reason. And what can I say? This happens often. It was adopted because the drafters had a particular person in mind whom they wanted to be Attorney General. And they could more certainly get that by having the Constitution provide that the state Supreme Court. And it was probably based on the individual composition of the Supreme Court at that time. So, I mean, in the sense that all politics is localized, I don't know of a policy reason why it's done that way. In my personal view, that provision does a good job of insulating the Attorney General from political considerations as much. And so he or she is able to give just straight on legal advice, like I would hope an attorney general would give. But I don't think that that was necessarily the reason why that provision was drafted the way that it was drafted. It may have been something as provincial as wanting a particular person in the office of attorney general.
Yeah, about 10 years ago, we had a program where Lewis Donaldson told us about his relative, who I think was maybe the first attorney general in Tennessee. You know, he told us a very interesting story.
Of just that.
Yeah, very interesting story. One of our attendees has this, and you spoke about this, but this maybe talk a little more deeply about it. Does the separation of powers in the Tennessee Constitution differ in application from the implied separation in the U.S. Constitution?
That is a good question. It's one that I have thought about. And it may depend on the particular situation that where the concept of separation of powers comes up. Separation of powers could be, the judiciary infringing on the executive infringing on the legislature. It could be, any dynamic among the three branches. Tennessee's history, though, does tell you that what founding citizens were quite concerned about at that time was legislative overreach, and in particular, legislative encroachment on the judiciary. So, to a certain extent, I think that has to inform our view of separation of powers in Tennessee, by knowing that legislative overreach, and in particular ways, was on the minds of those citizens. When cases come up that could involve legislative overreach on the judiciary, I think it's fair to take that into consideration. And also legislative overreach on the executive, because part of what was on the minds of citizens at that time was the fact that the governor really had no power. We still have a weak governor state, weak governor in quotes, not any particular governor, but our system is a weak governor system because, clearly with the governor's veto can be overridden by a mere majority in both houses of the legislature. But there are still executive functions. So I think it's fair to say that we can legitimately interpret Tennessee's separation of powers provisions in a very robust way. And in doing so, that would be consonant with our history.
One of our attendees has a question. It makes the observation that most constitutional cases you see where someone's complaining about state action, in his view, and I think this is true, rely a great deal or almost exclusively on the U.S. Constitution, and he's wondering why that would be. Why would not people rely more on the Tennessee Constitution, sort of given this more robust approach to individual liberties, in a case where you're, making allegations that particular governmental action was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, that's actually a really good and important point. And that's actually what I was talking about at the beginning of the presentation, that state constitutions really are coming into the light. Every lawyer who has a case and is advocating on behalf of his or her client is looking for whatever resource they can find. The United States Constitution is very familiar to all of us, and That's what we studied in law school. You probably didn't study state constitutions, although I think they're being taught more and more now. But lawyers can look to particular provisions in our state constitution. And I'm actually finding that more and more that lawyers in are using that, are putting that in their toolbox. And looking, I mean, you just get the state constitution out and you read it and you see whether there's anything in there that would be of use to your client. And so I think that's actually a really important point, and not just on the question of state action, but on a lot of different issues. If you look at the Tennessee Constitution, there may be a resource there that nobody's thought of that you would be able to raise on behalf of your client.
I have another question, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, because you may have a case that comes in front of you, but the question is, the comment is that the U.S. Constitution's taking clause is self-executing. And he asked, do you have an opinion as to whether the Tennessee taking clause is self-executing?
I do not. That's one of those areas that I really have not, trying to think in some of the taking, you know, I don't think that I have had a case, I'm going to out myself a little bit here. I don't know about all judges, but a lot of my study, it comes from a case that I had where I may not have studied the topic overall, for example, of eminent domain. But then when I get a case that involves it, I will do a deep dive into that area. And that's one area where I have not done a deep dive. So I really just don't know
the answer to that. Well, that's always a good answer. I always tell my witnesses in deposition, so you don't know if you don't know.
I'm pretty quick to do that. And I will, I would like the luxury of time to be able to sit back and really do general research on the Tennessee Constitution. But the reality is that I do a lot of dipping into it as the situation requires it. And then over time, all those pieces knit together like a puzzle and you get a more holistic view of it.
Here's another question. I think all of us on the program can relate to this. The $50 fine clause, I think that's an excellent clause. I'm glad you talked about that. But one of our attendees says, if there's no fine above $50 permitted by the Tennessee Constitution, what is a speeding ticket fine called? Can we get a jury trial on a speeding ticket?
I think that there's, I haven't had a lot of litigation on the fine clause, to tell you the truth. But I think that there's a lot of litigation over what's a fine and what's a penalty. I think that's essentially how a lot of it, that's the workaround that has been done on those. I actually would love to see some appeals on that, but it's never monetarily worthwhile for anybody to appeal those things. But I think that a lot of my recollection is that much of the litigation goes into whether something is a fine that would come under that constitutional provision or whether it's a penalty.
Here's a real softball question from a member attendee.
You've just jinxed me by saying that. That ensures that I won't know the answer.
You can't get this wrong. The question is, what is your favorite distinct provision of the state constitution?
My favorite provision of the state constitution is on appellate judges' retention elections, of course. That's my favorite. Second favorite, though, is separation of powers, to tell you the truth. I find the whole concept very interesting, and that's why I was really interested by the question one of the participants asked earlier about whether Tennessee would interpret its separation of powers provisions differently than the federal constitution. That's something that I have thought about, and we haven't had an opportunity for that to come up, but I think that's super interesting.
One of our attendees said that Judge Sutton has also proposed looking to state constitutions for solutions, but Tennessee's constitution is relatively easy to amend. How should that ease of revision factor into the equation?
Well, I think that, you know, that whether the ease of amendment to the Constitution should factor into what now? What was the question here?
Well, I think I'm not exactly clear on the question, but I think Judge Sutton had said that, you know, states, it's easier to amend a state constitution than the federal constitution. It's not easy at all. And so in terms of, you know, solving, if every state's constitution is easy to amend, I don't know about any other state. But in terms of trying to solve problems, I think maybe the question is, states should just look inward and try to fix problems in their own state, you know, through constitutional amendments where, you know, where they can legitimately do it, you know, vis-a-vis the federal constitution.
Well, I think I think we can see just in the current in our current legislature that amending the Constitution is very much on the minds of legislators. It's very hard to amend the federal Constitution, and it is not easy to amend the Tennessee Constitution. I can tell you, when we were out there campaigning, and I was actively campaigning on the Amendment 2 on the retention of appellate judges, it is hard, but it's certainly not as hard as the federal Constitution. I don't know really how that I don't know whether the question is, do we interpret it differently because of that? And my initial thinking is probably not, but I would be interested in hearing some of his thoughts on that, if he thinks it should be different because
Here's
of that.
Another question. Do you think the federal doctrine of incorporation has had a net positive or negative impact on the freedom of citizens? Has it hindered the development of state constitutional law?
Say the question again.
Yeah. Do you think the federal doctrine of incorporation has had a net positive or negative impact on the freedom of citizens? Has it hindered the development of state constitutional law?
I think actually it has some. That's a good insight. Just in the sense that state constitutions are eclipsed by the federal constitution by so much focus on it. I think that is Justice Brennan's entreaties to state Supreme Court justices to look to state constitutions actually was, I think, part of the trigger, because state constitutions before then had been kind of sleepy documents that people forgot about. And when state Supreme Courts started taking his advice and interpreting them, the state constitutions, in a way that was more consonant with what Justice Brennan would have preferred, people kind of waked up. And now they are well and truly waked up. And I think some law schools are now teaching law students about how state constitutions are interpreted differently from the federal constitution. And this is a good development, because lawyers, when I was coming up as a trial lawyer, I did not think much about the state constitution as a possible avenue for relief for my clients, but I think lawyers think about it much more readily now.
Um, Here's a question. We're kind of getting short on time here. Tennessee is one of the few states that retain chancery courts. However, we've essentially never respected the traditional distinction between law and equity in those courts. In many jurisdictions, what is filed in circuit as opposed to chantry is merely a matter of local custom. Can you speak to some about the origin of our strange bifurcated civil trial court structure?
Yeah, I actually kind of agree with the import of that. of that question. I think the chancery courts are special and courts of equity are special. The distinction between the two has been not completely lost. Generally, people who are seeking injunctive relief will think first of going to chancery court, but that's actually by statute. Because over time, it does become for lawyers, for litigants, for citizens, it's a little hard for them to distinguish, have I brought this to the wrong court? So they're actually, it's not just custom. It's also by statute that the jurisdiction of the circuit courts and the chancery courts now, there's almost complete overlap in them. But I love the heritage of the courts of equity from England and how they looked at things differently. In reading about courts of equity and sort of the majesty of taking a holistic view of the law and the all-wise chancellor doing what he thought was best in a particular case, as opposed to what the law required. There's some appeal to that, but statutes in Tennessee have rather purposefully eradicated much of the difference between those two courts.
One attendee has a question that, given the current composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, do you see more 10th Amendment cases being taken up or decided in favor of states?
I think it's kind of hard. I think it's a little hard to see how that is going to shake out. We've got several very new members on the court. They have disagreed in ways that have been surprising to me. So I'm kind of taking a wait and see approach. We know that, Justice Scalia certainly was considered to be conservative, but he took approaches in cases that often surprised me. And I suspect that some of these justices will. The newest justices, it's just too soon to see how they will turn out and who they will become as they remain on the court for a number of years. It's going to be really interesting to watch.
Justice Kirby, one of our attendees has a question. He's wondering if there are any general express provisions in the Tennessee Constitution that places limits. Reserves or limits local government powers of counties and municipalities, in terms of their power to do certain things. I guess a specific constitutional provision that says local governments can, including counties and municipalities can have these particular powers or can't do certain things.
There are some fairly specific provisions in the Tennessee Constitution about that topic. And I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly what they say, but they would be worthy of some study. As I mentioned, a number of them really are oriented toward empowering local government and restricting the ability of the legislature to enact private acts, for example, and essentially localized legislation. We can look back in Tennessee's history and see exactly why that was, because that was one of the more serious areas of what our citizens saw as overreach. I believe that there are some provisions that do the converse as well, though. And limit what localities can do. But I'm not 100% on that.
All right. Do you have any books that you would recommend? One of our attendees was wondering if you have any books you would recommend to learn more about how state constitutions operate. Are there any suggestions that you have?
There are a number of scholarly works on that. And I can't recite them off the top of my head, unfortunately, but there's been a lot of study on that. My friend Bill Koch is a real scholar in that issue and on that issue. I think that he would have some that he could probably reel off the top of his head. I do not. I have looked at a number of books, but I'm afraid I can't recite them to you right now.
Yeah, one attendee wants to know the link to watch court arguments. How could someone go and, you know, find that link? Is it on the AOC website?
If you go to the website, excuse me, for the Tennessee Administrative Office of the Courts, you will see a link to our YouTube channel. And they generally will have an alert that you'll see on the face of the website that says when the Court of Appeals is going to live stream arguments, when the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to live stream arguments, and when the Tennessee Supreme Court is going to live stream arguments. If you go to the YouTube channel, those are archived as well. So you can go back if you are interested in a particular case or you want to look. You know that a case is pending and you want to try to guess what either the intermediate appellate judges are going to rule or the Tennessee Supreme Court is going to rule. You can listen to the oral argument and do the guessing game from that. So they're not only live streamed, but they are archived. It's a really a great tool to look at.
All right. Well, we're out of time. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Justice Kirby. As always, we thank you. We thank Duncan for participating today in the program. And I want to thank everyone for attending. If you want CLE credit, and you haven't already sent me your CLE number either on the chat box or by email, please do. We're hopeful now. I hope everybody's getting a COVID-19 vaccine, because hopefully we're going to start having live programs again back at our place at the Hugh Hotel, formerly Grill 83, this summer. But we should have at least two more webcasts before then, so stay tuned. But anyway, we appreciate you attending today, and please join us for future Federalist Society programs. Thank you.